You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, a programming note before we get going. For the next hour and 40 minutes and 5 seconds, you're going to hear a conversation I had with Chris Bronzy, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps, still on active duty, a Colonel Select. Chris is a friend, battle buddy times two, great guy, graduated of the United States Naval Academy from very, very humble origins. And so you're gonna hear our first battlefield study. And what this is designed to do is it's designed at junior leaders in the Marine Corps or anybody in the Marine Corps. But more specifically, for people that want to get better, that want to learn, and want to hear about people's experiences in combat. And so that's what this battlefield studies is. The rest of it, you'll hear him articulate. The flow of it will be a quick introduction to Chris and his career. Then he'll give you an orientation, and then he'll walk through the contact of Golf Company 24 on 6-7 April 2004 in the city of Ramadi in the province of Al-Anbar in the country of Iraq. All right. Along with that, if you go to the All Marine Radio website, okay, so do that now, click on the podcast page, you'll see already up there, Battlefield Studies Maps. Click on that link. All right, now you're looking at two map chips. One is for April 6th, one is for April 7th. If you click on the map, like the little liner says there, right, it'll open as a PDF document, and you can enlarge that and as you listen. So those are the coordinating instructions that go with it. Without any further ado, in his own words, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy, United States Marine Corps, an infantry officer, has commanded Golf 24, along with being battalion commander of 1st Battalion 4th Marines, now working in Washington, D.C., doing something somewhere. All right, with that, Chris Bronzy. I can't tell you how long this segment has taken me to put together, okay? My guest this morning, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy, has been, not that he's been reluctant, but he's a busy guy, and he's been busy for a lot of years, probably since I've known him, but the day has come, and we're going to do the inaugural version of Battlefield Studies. So, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy, Colonel Select, joins us. Bronze, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Mac. Great to be on and great to talk to you.
All right. First of all, your first time on All Marine Radio, but you're no stranger to it, as we've been friends since. We're going to talk about Ramadi here, but Chris and I met in Ramadi in 2004. I was working for General Mattis Kelly and Colonel Dunford, and General Kelly decided he wanted to go on a visit to Combat Outpost, and he said, "You want to tag along?" And I knew a good friend of mine, Paul Kennedy, was going to be there, the commander of 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines at the time, and Chris was the commander of Golf Company, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "I've heard about this Bronzy guy. I want to go meet him if I can go." And so we went out there, and promptly got mortared with 120 millimeter mortars and then a machine gun, right? Somebody got hit up in that,
yep.
On that little tower you guys had built. And so, it was an eventful day. So, thanks for doing this. And, why do you think it's important that we do things like battlefield studies?
Well, like you and I have talked about so many times since we both, have shared history at the basic school. Personally, that was probably the most influential time in my Marine Corps career as far as just learning. And I would say it was not just because then-Colonel Allen forced us to read and discuss. Colonel Smith was there as the chief instructor, but also because they brought in a lot of great veterans, guys like Colonel Ripley, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Thompson, who's the CO-15 at Way City, Major General E. Toole Smith came and talked to us, and just shared their lessons learned. And I felt like those lessons that they emphasized with us also complemented all that reading we were doing. So it was almost like a multi-dimensional approach to making us better officers.
I feel the same way. So many of my peers, guys that, you know, we served with, and, you know, Paul Kennedy, Dave Furness, Lou Caporata, Jody Osman are all 2- and 3-star generals now. And John Kelly was a major. John Allen was a major there. But I think they all, it's interesting, they all point to that tour and the intellectual development that they did, being exposed to both the reading and then getting their hands on guys who were had practiced it already to be able to kind of, you know, pick their brain and ask them questions and then be able to learn from it. And again, the signature one for me is General Zenny and this combat concepts thing, which I looked at that and I said, man, there's so much I don't know about this profession. But the burning bush showed up one night and honestly changed my life. So along that vein, we'll do a battlefield study about Ramadi today in 2004 with Golf Company 2nd Battalion 4th Marines. Chris was the CO of that. First of all, let's learn about you. Born and raised where?
In a small town called Torquay, New York. It's about 70 miles north of Manhattan, almost straight north in the Hudson River Valley. Okay. And I was three of seven kids. My mom was a single parent. So I left high school, went to State University of New York Maritime College for just a year. And then the following year I got accepted and graduated from the Naval Academy in 1996.
How does that get on your radar, though? I mean, do you have any influence in your life that points you towards the Naval Academy and the Marine Corps? Was it a way to pay for college? How does the Naval Academy ultimately, and then the Marine Corps, how does the Marine Corps get into your life?
So I was, I worked for a guy who was a Vietnam veteran. He was a Marine. And, I was just bussing tables and, cleaning up a small restaurant. And, he just talked about his experiences in Vietnam very, very rarely, but it always intrigued me. The whole Vietnam generation were, folks that I looked up to. And, you know, the Marine Corps did a great job of selling their propaganda to me. I'm a true believer. So, I knew I wanted to join the military, particularly the Marine Corps, but I didn't make the connection between college and, the difference between officer and enlisted. So when I, was having a session with one of my teachers, a physics teacher when I was in high school, he said, hey, you ought to think about the Naval Academy. So, my guidance counselor, thankfully, was a great guy. And, he helped me through it. And of course, I didn't get through, or I didn't get accepted my first, time around, but I just persisted. And I also had a couple uncles in my family, one in particular on my mother's side, who worked as a civilian in the Marine Corps. So as I started that journey my junior year in high school, he was a terrific mentor and a terrific example and, helped steer me to that ultimate goal of getting into the Naval Academy and being commissioned as a Marine.
Was when you went to the Naval Academy, were you intent on being a Marine when you got there? Was that something that developed while you were there?
No, it was definitely with me when I showed up. And, I had a great staff NCO, assistant MOI at Maritime who reinforced that. Staff Sergeant Rubio. He actually wound up a Master Gunnery Sergeant in 2nd Corps Div. I think he was a Master Gun there when I was leaving my first unit, 2-2. But he was hard as nails and, just further reinforced my belief that the Marine Corps was where I belong.
All right, tell us about your career. You get commissioned, and you go to IOC, you go to the basic school IOC, and where do you head from there?
First duty station was 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marines, myself and two other 2nd Lieutenants, Kelly Grissom, Matt Zeman, checked into Weapons Company, which is a little bit strange for 2nd Lieutenants to go straight to Weapons Company. But we had a great, we had a great team. My CO, who got out as a major, Dan O'Donnell, was one of the most influential, charismatic leaders I've ever worked for. So I did that for 3 years, had the cap platoon for about 18 months, deployed to the med on a LF-6F, and then came back, was a weapons company XO, really for probably the remainder of my time, with the exception of being a weapons company commander for probably about 5 months while we waited for a guy to graduate school. And then went up to TBS, did about 18 months there as an instructor, and then moved across the street to Mitchell Hall, where I finished out my last 18 months at IOC. And then I got selected for the field artillery captain's career course, oddly enough.
Cool.
And I left there in January 2003, so I watched the Marine Corps march up to Baghdad on TV, which was a little bit frustrating, as you might imagine. I was convinced I missed the war, which turned out to be false. And then I checked into 2-4 in summer of 2003, did a deployment to Ramadi as a golf company CO, came back, took weapons company on 31st MU, and then I became the OPSO for probably only about 5 or 6 months before I left to go instruct again in Quantico at the Expedition Warfare School. Let me see, then I went to England for a year. I did my command and staff college over in the UK, and then that's when I reunited with you in RCT1 2010, did a year in Afghanistan, then a year as the OPSO before I joined 1-4, and then, let's see, 2 years of 1-4 about, did 13th MU, and then I went to the War College in D.C., 2 years on the Joint Staff, and then I've been a Headquarters Marine Corps since.
All right. The let's talk about kind of give us an orientation on Ramadi. Now, just so everybody knows, if you're listening to this right now, if you go to the website, Chris is going to make references to some maps, and they're all on the website. So all you have to do is you know, roll there on your phone, or if you're sitting and listening at your computer, go ahead and go over to there, and you'll be able to see the map chips that he's talking about. So give us an orientation relative to the general situation, and then take us through what we're going to talk about today.
So early 2004, we relieved, I think it was a Florida National Guard unit, but we actually did our relief in place in Kuwait because they had gone home and the 82nd Airborne Division had assumed the battle space in Ramadi. So physically we did our turnover with the 82nd Airborne Division or elements of 82nd. And I think the map chip that everyone will see has kind of the western boundary as a cemetery. You could kind of see a cleared out space in the upper left-hand corner or northwestern corner of the slide. Some of the key terrain is MSR Michigan up to the north, which runs west to east. And obviously, if you follow it east, you run into Fallujah. If you follow it west, I think it goes all the way out to Al-Qaim and Hisseba area. And then a couple water towers, a couple checkpoints. Some of the key checkpoints for us were 296, which is just northeast of the cemetery. And the Saddam Mosque was there in the center of the city. Big intersection, lots of traffic, not only vehicular, but also civilian traffic during the days. And then as you move just east of that checkpoint, there's a street that kind of runs southeast, so from the northwest to the southeast, and it hits a soccer stadium, which is clearly visible on the map chip. And that is the Al-Farouk area of Ramadi. My Marines affectionately referred to that as the Heart of Darkness. And if you keep moving along MSR Michigan east, you'll get to checkpoint 297. And a few hundred meters east of that is the combat outpost where both my company, elements of HMS Company and Echo Company, were living for those 7+ months.
Okay. All right. And that's how long your deployment was, 7 months?
Yep, just over, I think.
Okay. Talk to us about, so what are we going to talk about in terms of the specific event?
So if it's all right with you, Mac, I'll just kind of walk through, you know, and I can talk really about anything. Nothing's off the table, but just that first major engagement that the golf company and really the battalion, the Magnificent Bastards, had on 6th and 7th of April. A lot of lessons learned. I think a lot of lessons that we learned, not only because it's our first major engagement, but also because I think our success on those few days, and I really was only engaged as a company for two, but I know Weapons Company had, you know, more of an extensive engagement just that lasted over a few more days. But because I think it reflected the preparation that we did going into that deployment. And I also think it reflects the agility that we tried to demonstrate as we tried to be a learning organization. You know, the enemy obviously adapts, and we were, I won't even say we were trying, so we had to keep pace with his adaptation so that we could continue to maintain the initiative. But yeah, some of those lessons were hard learned, but some of them were invaluable. You know, 2-5 relieved us in September of 04, and I'd like to think, you know, we were able to provide them some lessons that they wouldn't have to learn themselves. So yeah, if that, that works for you, that's what we'll talk about.
Okay, in terms of when you guys obviously, you talk to the Florida National Guard guys down in Kuwait, you come in, you're doing left seat, right seat with the 82nd Airborne. What was your expectation going into the battle space? Because this is relatively early in the deployment. You guys wind up, when do you actually rip bronze?
I think the actual date for the rip was, I want to say it was like the 13th of March. It was early March, and we, it was only about a week long. We had showed up, we flew out of Pendleton on the 19th of February, and we did spend probably over a week in Kuwait, and then we convoyed north. But I'll tell you that the expectation that I had was not what we actually wound up doing during deployment. And part of that was, you know, the intelligence picture, I think, was unclear. And I think our mission was different than our predecessors. I had a guy from one of the company commanders that took me around on patrol told me, "Hey, man, you're not going to be doing much more than cutting ribbons and kissing babies." And that was based off of his limited time in Ramadi, but his, you know, he had a pretty long deployment, I think in an AO that was just west of Ramadi. And that was his experience, but it was not accurate as far as what we would be doing. So I, you know, I thought we'd be doing a lot of stability and, you know, support operations. I didn't necessarily expect that we would see as many, you know, combat engagements as we saw, but thankfully, I think that's what we trained for. And I'd like to think we were prepared.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I can remember going to the Division Theater before we left. And so this would have had to have been, you know, around the 1st of February. But before we left, and I remember General Mattis speaking, and, you know, I think it was all the officers from the division were supposed to be there. And, you know, and it, you know, we were taking both colored utilities. You know, we were initially going to wear tans, but we wanted to, you know, to switch to greens as soon as possible to show them that we didn't feel like we needed to be camouflaged and that we were there to support stability operations. And so, I mean, I think, I mean, it was a very, very broad mindset that we would get beyond the kinetics very quickly, hopefully, and then get on to stabilizing the region. And then be out of a job relatively quickly. So I think going in, that was the mindset. The so you guys rip on March and on March around March 13th, and then
right.
And then this engagement happens when because Ramadi essentially Al Anbar explodes, you know, Fallujah explodes, Ramadi explodes, and Huseyba 3-7 Matt Lopez was out there. With 3-7, a good buddy of ours, Trent Gibson, was out there, and I know a good friend of yours was killed out there, Captain Gannon, and you know the it exploded, and I remember just before the 82nd Airborne Ops guys left, they looked at us and they said, "We've never seen this like this." And truth be told, there was probably twice as many people out there beating the bushes in terms of Marines as there was in 82nd Airborne battalions and companies. We're a lot denser. and got after it. And it was just every day more and more kinetic events. And they were looking around when they left, and they said, hey, man, because I was working in the G3, hey, good luck. Something's not right here. Something's not right here. And they were uneasy when they left because they felt like something was going on that they didn't really have their hands around. And into that, you guys walk in Ramadi. So talk to us about the lead up to the first week in April. What kind of contact had you made, and how were your guys doing, and what did you think?
So the unit that actually took our company around was a mech unit. So I think mechanized, motorized, I think they spent most of their time in vehicles. And they were also, you know, an Army infantry company doesn't have as many personnel as a Marine infantry company.
Right.
At least back then it didn't. So what the advantage we had was we got out, like you mentioned, and, you know, we were beating the streets with a lot more numbers than I think that city had seen. And I think that had some advantages for us because it afforded us the opportunity over those 3 weeks leading up to this first major engagement to do reconnaissance. And, you know, that is one lesson learned that I always stress to the folks that I talk to is we walked, you know, almost every inch of that city, and we did it so we could become familiar with, you know, the population as much as possible. And I don't know that we made, you know, much headway with them. But what we were able to do was study the terrain, appreciate the environment, realize where some of the key terrain was, and then also figure out what our limitations were in terms of motorized patrols, where you could get vehicles, where you couldn't, where you were exposed, you know, dismounted, and then also where you could communicate from. So that was one of the things my radio operator and myself, you know, the company staff, and then all the platoon command elements studied very closely was, you know, where were there gaps in communication so that we could either set up relay points or at least know what risk we were accepting, because obviously once you made contact, you know, the risk of the casualty increased, and you're going to have to make sure you get those casualties out of the battle space and get treated. But up until the 6th of April, most of our engagements were pretty limited. We didn't have great success killing the enemy, but they were only hitting us in small numbers, mostly IEDs, direct fire, and I think up until that point I probably had only about a dozen Marines wounded. When I say only,
right.
I had about a dozen wounded, and most of them were gunshot wounds, shrapnel from RPG, and a few small IEDs. A few of the Marines were very serious injuries and had to be medevaced. I'd say maybe half a dozen of them. And maybe about three of those did not return. So, but the 6th of April was when we were actually able to make contact, maintain contact with the enemy.
Right. Had you had any of your Marines up to that point been killed?
No.
Okay.
I had no Marines that had been killed.
Okay, and then before we go on, just talk about, if you could, how you guys communicated. And then how you guys ran medevac, was it all CASEVAC? Did we use, you know, any kind of aviation assets? And then also talk about how at the time you used supporting arms. So kind of flesh out, operate, you know, the way you, in terms of the way you were operating at the time, what was normal?
So as far as medevac, and I'll tell you, weapons company was terrific. Because, you know, they were essentially the mobile assault company, and we were mostly dismounted up to that point. You know, I did have a certain number of vehicles, but weapons company, at least for me, Rob Weiler was a company commander. Him and his Marines served as, you know, the CASEVAC platform for us. There was nowhere in the city that we were going to be bringing aviation assets into unless we, and I forgot to mention this when we were doing the orientation, you know, our firm base combat outpost was on the eastern edge of the city, and we had an LZ at the beginning of the deployment just outside the compound in one of the fields, and then we eventually threw some stone or some rock down, and Captain Shannon Fields, our FAC, built an LZ in the northern part of the compound. So we could medevac from there, or, you know, typically our motorized element, which was small in April, and we got a lot more trucks as deployment went on, we could take Marines and sailors west to either Battalion CP, Hurricane Point, or a lot of times Rob and his guys would take them to the higher level echelon of care at Camp Junction City, which was just across the canal.
But
on the western side of the city.
So the vast majority of your casualties were evacuated via ground.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And honestly, Mac, we didn't use supporting arms throughout that whole deployment. I can maybe count on one hand how many opportunities we had to use aviation inside the city, and we were not very successful because of the challenges that existed with CAS in an urban environment. And, quite frankly, as the division told us, we were a supporting effort to the main effort, which was, east of us in Fallujah.
And people will find that hard to believe that, given the way we've used and the evolution of aviation ordnance in Afghanistan and later in Iraq, how, we shrunk the size of the pieces of ordnance, how, they've always been pretty accurate, but we were willing to use it in an urban environment. But in 2004, again, I'm sure people looked when you said we didn't use them. Same thing for RDS.
Right. Yeah, only a few times do I ever remember using our organic 60-millimeter mortars. And that was typically when I was operating outside of the AO that I was assigned, which was the city, and when I was operating north or east of the combat outpost in Echo Company's AO. So, and this brings me back to one of the most important lessons of that deployment, and that is you have to learn to fight and win with what you carry on your back. You can't depend on... I think you need to plan for supporting arms, and you need to be proficient in employing supporting arms, whether it's artillery, mortars, aviation. But if that is your decisive bid for victory, I would tell you that you're not setting yourself and your unit up for success, at least in the environment that I'm familiar with.
Okay.
But I would go so far as to say in any environment.
Okay. And then real quick, go back, you're communicating with just VHF comms? Are you using anything else?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we were just using VHF, other than what our forward air controls were using with the aircraft. But on the 6th and 7th of April, I didn't have a forward air controller with me on either one of those days.
So essentially, what you're describing is not too much different than what Marines did in Hue, what soldiers did in urban fighting in Europe in the 1940s. We're not using a whole lot of supporting arms, which may make it different from even that, because they were not afraid to use supporting arms in Europe. And certainly after about the first 48 hours of Hue, they decided that, yeah, we're going to rearrange the city if we have to, but we're going to stop dying. But we weren't at that point, and we were still not using supporting arms. So pretty different experience. And then underneath what you guys see being new to the city, there's an infiltration going on into the city, yes?
Yes. I remember General Kennedy called them commuter insurgents because a lot of them were trying to make their way east to Fallujah, and they were coming from the Syrian border. So they were passing through our good friends from 37's AO out in Al-Qaim and Hiseba. And as you can imagine, they were hard to track because, they looked like almost everybody else in the city with a few exceptions. So they were working their way east in a lot of cases, and they would stop off. I'd like to think that a lot of them didn't finish their journey because of the efforts of the Magnificent Bastards, but a lot of them tried. And, the enemy had a tremendous counter-reconnaissance capability, and they were also able to infiltrate pretty effectively.
All right. So and so, just that is the lay of the land as kind of the calendar flips to the first week of April in 2004. My guest is Chris Bronzy. We're doing the inaugural battlefield study here on All Marine Radio. My thanks to Chris for coming on and doing this. And so, Chris, walk us through the events of the 6th and 7th of April.
So the, let me think, the 5th, I think it was Weapons Company, did a raid on the night of the 5th. And Rob Weiler and his guys were going after a couple significant targets. And this is just based off some of the conversations I've had with Rob afterwards. I think they were successful in finding who they were after. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, that whole province was blowing up, you know, at different times, you know, in April. I think Al-Qaim and Husayba was a little bit, you know, maybe a week or so after us. But Fallujah, you know, when those contractors were murdered and hung from the bridge, you know, the RCT kind of encircled the city. And I remember General Kennedy specifically telling us, you know, that was going on and that we could probably expect an uptick in enemy contact. And so with that raid that Rob's guys did in Whiskey Company, we think that was one of the triggers, because I think Rob and his guys caught the enemy off guard, and as I mentioned, their communications was terrific, the enemy's communications, so word got out very quickly, and we think they may have triggered the offensive that, you know, our company, you know, the Jokers from Golf Company, ran into the following morning. So we were just doing routine.
You want to hear Small World stuff? I was on that raid.
Oh, with Rob.
Kennedy calls me and he says, "Hey, you want to go AI a raid with me?" I said, "I'm not Lieutenant Colonel Kennedy, now Major General Kennedy." I said, "I don't know if I can. I mean, I have to ask Colonel Dunford, but you know, maybe let me ask." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I could. I'd be curious to see what you think." And now Paul Kennedy and I are great friends. We taught together at the basic school. We taught together at IOC. We've done a lot of research on decision making together. We've written a paper called "Why Does the First Fire Team Rush Together?" that was published in the Gazette. It's still a great paper. You should read it. And so I wound up going over there, and we went down and saw the police chief. And I didn't get out that much, and so it was an incredible education for me. We were headed downtown. We stop about a half mile before the police station, and we dismount. And I said, "Why are we dismounting here?" He said, "Well, they know we're coming, so we're probably going to get ambushed." I went, "Oh." So let me tell you, one of the scariest things I ever did was walk into that police station in Ramadi, and you had all these Iraqi policemen, I guess in theory, you know, with their, you know, with their red and white headdresses on and with their Kalashnikovs hanging across their chest, and you're walking in there. And I remember thinking, it's scarier in here than it is out there. And so Sergeant Major Booker, Jim Booker, who's an awesome guy, was next to me, and I said, we were in kind of the back of the movement, and I said, "Is it me or is it scarier in here?" He said, it's straight up scarier in here. And then we went out on that raid, and then another good friend of ours, the OPSO, of the following morning, I got up. And you know, one of the things when you're, you know, doing ride-alongs with that, people being gracious, is you don't want to be a pain in the ass. And, you know, somebody has to go out of their way to take you someplace. And so Dave Harrell, who was a major, was heading over to Camp Ramadi. And I heard that he was headed there, and I said, "Hey, Dave, can you swing by Blue Diamond and kick me out?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Easy." And I remember by the time I had got into the CP, the fight in Ramadi had started. In a big way. So, small world stuff. So how do you first hear, and how are you guys first, what's your first contact in Golf Company out in combat outposts.
So at that point of deployment, Gulf Company was responsible for securing the government center in partnership with the Iraqis. And my first, or elements of the first platoon was there, Joker 1, and they started heading back early that morning because they were relieved by Joker 3, our third platoon. So Joker 3 took three separate routes, west on MSR Michigan with vehicles, to quickly conduct the relief in place for first platoon, and then they had two squads that were moving, one probably only a few hundred meters south of Michigan from east to west, and then, that was, the third squad. And the first squad, they had their platoon sergeant with them, and, Sergeant Holt was their squad leader. They moved a little bit further south, probably about a click or so of MSR Michigan. And all three platoons were going to link up, or excuse me, all three squads were going to link up as a platoon at the government center and spend about 8 to 12 hours, doing local security patrols there. And it was on their way west across the city that then Corporal Egging, who would later be meritoriously promoted to sergeant, combat meritoriously promoted to sergeant, made contact in a cemetery. And, you know, I was at the CP, first platoon had just gotten back. They debriefed me on what was pretty uneventful night. And I remember Sergeant Egging, or Corporal Egging at the time, calling in his contact report. And Lance Corporal Letterman had received some shrapnel to the face from an RPG. So at first look, I thought it was, you know, another one of those limited engagements, no big deal, you know, like a good squad leader. He was fighting a squad and he said he didn't, you know, there was no indication that he needed reinforcements or that he needed, a medevac. So only a few minutes later, I think Letterman gets a gunshot wound to the stomach, to the abdomen, same Marine. And, Weapons Company, we decided Weapons Company would conduct the medevac. So I forget which whiskey platoon it was, which mobile assault platoon, but they came in from the west to medevac Letterman. And then that southern squad, Joker 3-1, made contact, and they very quickly became isolated, outnumbered, and started to sustain casualties. And once their contact was pretty heavy, you know, the platoon sergeant who was with him, then Staff Sergeant, now retired Sergeant Major Rodriguez, he needed a QRF. He let me know it, so then I rolled into the city with the first platoon that had just left the government center. And we inserted too far to the east, and I was basing that off of a patrol overlay. Again, another lesson that everybody knows about, you know, first reports are often inaccurate. And the position that they had called into me was in reference to the water tower. And, so that's where I inserted and, wound up being about a click further east than, it probably should have been. And as soon as we dismounted and started moving west to link up with them, we made contact. And I think it took us about 45 minutes to find our way to that, first, squad of third platoon.
All right. So describe it. Describe what they're doing, describe what you're doing, and describe how this thing develops during the course of the next, during the course of that day.
So 3-1 was in, they were in a bad situation, and 3-3, Joker 3-3 was in a cemetery. And although they had sustained, what was now an urgent casualty in Lance Corporal Letterman, Weapons Company was quick to arrive on scene. You know, the platoon commander, John Hessner, grabbed his radio operator. He basically moved, I think, about 800 meters across the city, just south of MSR Michigan, to link up with his third squad and fight with those guys. So I felt pretty good about where 3-3 was. 3-1, not so much, because they were further south in the city, and they were taking a lot of casualties. I didn't know how severe it was until I actually physically linked up with them. But, you know, I was with the entire first platoon down in the Farouk area by a soccer stadium, slowly moving our way up Easy Street, trying to cross Easy Street. And Easy Street is that prominent terrain feature that basically goes from the Saddam Mosque down to the soccer stadium. Kind of ironic that it was named Easy Street, but we didn't name it that. It was handed over to us from the Army. And, you know, Mac, to be honest with you, it was everything that I had read about in terms of, you know, what combat in an urban environment was like. You know, we were receiving fire, obviously, from the street level, from the rooftops. It seemed like at times in some of the more narrow alleyways, grenades were just being tossed over, you know, the compound walls. It was very chaotic. One of the things that I think has stayed with me from that engagement and all the engagements really is how difficult it is to link up with a unit that's in contact. And Whiskey 3 was quick to get on the scene, and when they showed up, you know, they brought with them the heavy guns, so they were enabling our movement across some of the larger terrain features, you know, the danger areas. But it took, you know, it took, like I said, 45 minutes to get to 3-1. And Corporal Joe Hayes from California, interestingly enough, he was the first Marine from Trooper 3-1 that I linked up with. So he's on a street corner, and he's wounded, and he's with two other Marines from his fire team, one of which is wounded. And they're east by probably, you know, 100 or 150 meters from where the platoon sergeant and squad leader were holed up. Come to find out, the reason they were holed up in a compound was because two Marines that had moved to secure a street corner had been, you know, one had been wounded severely, the other had been killed, so they were using that as a casualty collection point. And Hayes' fire team had moved to reduce an enemy strong point, and while they were moving, one of their Marines was killed. So when I link up with Hayes, you know, I'm ecstatic. I'm thinking, hey, this is great. We finally made contact with their platoon, which was what we were after the whole, you know, the whole morning. And it's getting close to noon at this point, maybe a little bit later. So I see Hayes, like, all right, Corporal Hayes, what's going on? And he's like, sir, we got to get Halal. And I'm thinking, okay, let's get him. Where is he? And it didn't register with me. But then he looks at me, he's like, sir, he's dead. And it kind of, it took the wind out of my sails a little bit, a lot, actually. And so he pointed out that the Marine had been struck, mortally wounded, and he was in the street. So at that point, the brigade commander shows up. And Colonel Connor, he was from 1st BCT, 1st ID. And he said to me, Chris, what do you need? And I was so thankful that he asked me that because he didn't give me any direction. He didn't tell me how to do anything. He just asked me what I needed. As a colonel, you know, as a brigade commander, I said, sir, if you can help me evac my casualties, that'd be great, because I'm thinking I knew he would get them to Junction City and take care of them, and then I could focus on, you know, continuing the fight. So we recovered Halal. We loaded him up. We recovered the Marine who had been shot through the face, Gentile, great Marine. He wound up living. He had his carotid arteries severed, and he wound up making it thanks to the efforts of that whole squad. I mean, it was superhuman what they were able to do. And I'm telling you, Mac, when I say they were in the middle of the city, I mean, they were in the middle of the city and completely surrounded. And because they were there so long, I mean, you know as well as I do, the enemy figured it out and were throwing everything they had at them. But they held on and they fought their asses off, and they killed a lot of enemy. And once we linked up, we took third platoon with us, and then we'd continue.
Can I stop you there? I want to ask you two things, leadership things. One, how long did it take you? You said, I mean, your first Marine's killed in action. How long did it take you to kind of process that and to keep going? And is it in this engagement where you kill the first guy that you kill in combat?
It was. It was before I had linked up with that squad from 3rd Platoon.
Right,
it was actually as I was trying to cross Easy Street.
All right. I asked you about that once, and you told me a story, so I'd appreciate it if you'd recount it, because I know there's a lot of, you know, young leaders that think about, well, you know, will I be up for it? Can I do that? And I think it'd be illustrative if you just talked about your experience. But talk first about, you know, your first KIA. Is it something that you dwelled on? Did you not have time to dwell on it because of the events in front of you, but later on that day? Or that evening, you know, when you had time alone, you know, it came back. Talk to us about that.
So two thoughts actually came to my mind after that occurred, and I'll get to that in a second. But it was, you know, I was trying to cross Easy Street, and I didn't even have my radio operator, my company radio operator that day, because we were trying to get out of the combat outpost so fast, I couldn't wait for him. And so I took Joe Mahardy, who was First Platoon's radio operator, and I said, "Hey, Mahardy, you're with me." So he was, and what a terrific man. I think he's serving in the Army now as a warrant officer or an officer. But anyway, so he and I are waiting to cross Easy Street, and you know, cars are just screaming up and down the street. Not that it was the civilians, I think, trying to get air there, but it was also a lot of insurgents who were, you know, dropping guys off and picking casualties up. So I remember looking south on Easy Street and seeing this vehicle just screaming towards us, and I looked back to Mahardy, who's to my south behind me, and I said, "Hey, you know, keep an eye on R6, because I didn't know which street we're going to come up." And then I looked back onto Easy Street, and, you know, we're taking fire, and, you know, the car screeches to a stop, doors fly open, I turn back around to Mahardy to tell him, like, "Hey, man, it's coming." And as soon as I turn around, this guy is literally, you know, 3 or 4 feet from me. And so I engage him, and he drops. And the two things that went through my mind, one was, okay, you know, I can do this. I didn't have any visceral reaction to it or any strange physiological reaction to it. And, you know, you've read Grossman and you know all the studies that have been done, and some people have those reactions, and there's nothing wrong with it because they just push through it. And then the next thing I remember thinking, because he wasn't dead yet, was that, you know, I'm not expending any more ammunition on this guy because I'm going to need it. And then I started looking across the street, and, you know, elements of First Platoon had made it across the street, and we were next. So not a lot of time to dwell on it. But, you know, it's funny, this came up in a PME that I was doing with a company of lieutenants at TDS, and they asked, you know, a similar question. And I said, you know, it's hard for you to appreciate your training and how important it is, but that is what you default to in high-stress situations. And so the more you repeat, the more you rehearse, the more able, I believe, you're going to be able to transition from, you know, a chaotic moment, a stressful moment, to focusing back again on your mission, if that makes sense to you.
No, it does. And but I think it's interesting to hear it, you know, from your perspective. This the first time you're doing it, your head's in the game. You're doing a lot of things you've been trained to do, and those things are kicking in. All right, keep going.
So we finally when we linked up as a, you know, really the, you know, two platoons, company minus, you know, we got all the casualties evacuated, and then we just started clearing west of the city, probably for the next few hours. I was moving with 3rd Platoon and 1st Platoon. 2nd Platoon was back at the combat outpost securing it. And 4th Platoon had entered
into
the fight as well.
Could you reorient us? I'm looking at the map of April 6th. I can see Route Michigan in green. I can see the soccer stadium. Where are you guys right now in terms of as you begin to execute your sweep and begin to take the fight to the enemy?
So almost due south of checkpoint 296, which is where the Saddam Mosque is. So it's almost probably about a kilometer west. Directly west of the soccer stadium.
Okay, got it.
And we kept moving almost as far west as the government center. We wound up linking up with General Kennedy and the command element, forward command element. And then, you know, that was kind of our limit of advance. We considered, at least I was thinking, you know, this is territory that we've cleared. We own it, and I was prepared to start digging in, so to speak, and, you know, occupying, finding positions, resupplying that night. But the environment at that point was not, it wasn't what the division wanted to do. it wasn't what the battalion wanted to do, you know, to occupy more ground or more territory in the city. So we wound up heading east again, you know, clearing remnants of enemy positions, and then finally made it back to the firm base or the combat outpost that night, probably about, I want to say it was like 1700, 1800, maybe a little bit later.
Okay, and talk to us about, so the sun sets in on that day, and which, how many casualties do you have? What are your thoughts as a company commander in terms of what you had out there in front of you that you would ultimately go back and fight the next day?
So I had two Marines killed, both from Joker 3-1, PFC-OL, from Indianapolis, Indiana, and PFC Moises Langhorst from Moose Lake, Minnesota. And there were probably, you know, I'd have to count maybe a half a dozen other Marines that were wounded, mostly from 3rd Platoon, and those were the guys that made initial contact.
Right.
And honestly, Mac, is, you know, one of the first things I did was I went and found 3rd Platoon, at least the guys that I had not seen. You know, we relieved, we reinforced with 4th Platoon, elements of 4th Platoon at the government center for that night. And then we, you know, I went and found that platoon and I talked to them. And, you know, like I told the lieutenants and some of the captains that I've spoken to, yeah, what are you going to say? I don't know, but you got to find something to say. Be honest with them. Be yourself. And tell them that, you know, hey, I'm sorry that, you know, we lost one of our Marines, one of our sailors, one of our brothers. But, this is what I told them. Maybe it wasn't what they wanted to hear. Clean your weapons. Drink some water. Get some chow. Reload your magazines. Get some more frag grenades. Get some, you know, load up on high casualty producing ordnance. Get some sleep because we're going to be back at it the next day, and in fact, we were.
How did they take that?
Like men, like you'd expect. I mean, you know, they're tired. I mean, we're all tired, I think, after that first day. But they took it like men.
Hey, Bronze, let me describe the weather. We haven't spoken too much about that, but. Describe the weather, this part. It's the spring in El Anbar. Daytime temperature is what?
I'd say it's creeping up towards 90, you know, on the high end, and at least in the 80s. I mean, you know, it's getting towards low 100s towards the heat of summer, maybe actually 115 at its highest.
Right.
So that's a very polite way, Mac, of you telling me that I failed my orientation. I appreciate that.
No, you know, if I would have remembered, I would have told you, but I didn't remember, so it's on me as the host. But no, it's not insignificant because there is no timeout, right? There is no water break. There's only fighting and killing and moving and communicating. And that's what's there. And there is no break. So it's significant.
And so, again, you know, the importance of discipline and the importance of supervision and the importance of inspections at the small unit leader level, you hit the nail on the head. You know, you may not refill your canteens. You may not be able to refill your camelback during 6 to 8 hours of fighting and moving and, you know, moving casualties. And, you know, you're certainly not going to be taking time to eat. So if you're not staying hydrated, you know, over the course of the days preceding that engagement, you're going to become a liability, and you're going to decrease the relative combat power of your unit. So I can't overemphasize enough, and I probably sound like a broken record to, you know, students that I've had, but that basic small unit leadership, that high degree of discipline that we've prided ourselves on for so many years becomes, you know, even more important in an environment like this. I mean, you can't get away with not doing it when you're on a, you know, company mobility hike or a displacement operation when you're training. But in this environment, you know, and I don't just mean combat. I mean in this environment, in the Middle East where it's this hot and this unforgiving, you know, in the mountains of Afghanistan, you cannot afford to not do those types of things.
Because
you got to be in shape.
Because it will directly impact your combat power and your ability to fight.
Absolutely.
Bottom line. Bottom line. All right. So anything else that happens throughout the course of the night or before you guys LD the next morning?
Well, I did some planning with the 2nd Platoon. 2nd Platoon was the only platoon that had not made contact that day because they were securing the firm base.
Right.
Where they, you know, talk about a testament to that platoon. You know, I used to call them, my bloodlust platoon because they were some mean SOBs. And I mean that in a good way.
Right.
But they were hungry to get after it. And so the platoon commander and I talked about, you know, where they would go on their patrol the next morning. And I sent them right back to the area where we had the most contact, you know, just a few hundred meters south of MSR Michigan between the government center and, Saddam Mosque. And that next morning, probably about the same time, you know, mid morning, platoon commander gives me a call, says, "Hey, sir, looks like, things are pretty quiet, more quiet than usual because a lot of the shops were still closed down and not too many people were out on the streets." And probably within a few minutes of that call, he called me with a contact report, and I could hear the machine gun RPG fire in the background. And that's kind of when I realized what I had told the Marines the night before, you know, that we were going to basically be doing the same thing, and we wound up doing the same thing that next day on the 7th. We were more prepared. You know, we kind of knew what we were getting into, and we went out there with 3rd and 4th platoon, and 2nd platoon was unit in contact. So, you know, 3rd and 4th had been fighting the day prior, so they were, I mean, it's funny, you can't say they were, you know, seasoned veterans, but even that, you know, 6 or 8 hours of fighting that we had done the day before had been transformational in how they thought and how they approached things, and they were significantly, I think, more effective. We all were just with one day of a sustained engagement under our belts.
Interesting. Just that confidence piece.
And I mean, there was certainly, you know, a motivation to get out there and get after it, especially when everyone had seen the effects, the cost. But you know, unit leaders, I think, did a great job of, you know, preventing things from being carried too far, which is always, you know, something you got to consider, especially as a leader in that environment.
Talk to me about that, if you would. Because it is controlling the bloodlust after we take casualties is not an easy thing. And, I know from just my job in a combat operations center when Marines are killed, and, you know, we have aviation assets up or we're watching guys on drone. You know, there's people that they want those people dead, but you got to do it the right way so that bad things don't happen and you don't make things worse. Talk to us about, did you say anything about it? Did you just let the leaders there, do what you knew they were capable of doing? How did you address it at all? Because again, when your friends get killed, you're pissed, and you're not a little bit pissed. You're blood pissed, and when your blood's pumping,
right,
and you want to kill them, you want to make them dead, and and I think a lot of people, your first reaction is, and if other people get hurt, so be it. But you've got to, you know, and I've said this before. I don't think we do a good job with explaining why you keep your honor clean. You keep your honor clean because you have to go to bed every night and lay your head on your pillow. And if you don't keep your honor clean, it will come visit you every night. And we've all watched it here in the last week. 4 different sheriffs down in Florida did not respond to a shooter that was killing innocent children. And fate will be very unkind to them because they have to live with that inaction for the rest of their life. And so, to me, when we talk about keep your honor clean, it's really important because there's a difference between killing in combat and murder. And everybody who's fought knows the difference. And people that are unfortunate enough to make grave mistakes through negligence or other mistakes by commission because they weren't reined in, have to live with that stuff forever, and it ruins people's lives. And I would recommend if you want more evidence of that, just go on YouTube today, and just watch interviews with guys from Mealy, and watch interviews they did in 1969, 1970 with guys who were there, and then they did them again in 1988, 20 years after the event. And look how it's ruined their lives. And so the whole concept of keep your honor clean and leading when your guys are pissed is not an unimportant part of small unit leadership. It's a huge leadership. So did you say anything that night, Bronze? How did you deal with it?
I did. And, you know, thankfully, and Mac, you know, the chain of command that we had in the 1st Marine Division emphasized that repeatedly, you know, about keeping our honor clean. And General Kennedy spoke to us about battlefield character. You know, what is it? It's being decisive in an uncertain environment and following a decision through with disciplined violence of action while keeping your honor intact. And so, you know, that was a great environment to be a company commander. And you don't appreciate how important it is to go through these TDGs and to go through these escalation of force exercises and these rules of engagement, and to emphasize how important it is to not only respect one another as Marines and sailors, but to respect the people we're living among or protecting, and also to respect the enemy that we're going to defeat. Like, those are all different aspects of who we respect and how we respect them. But I unapologetically said to my Marines, you know, that night, oh, you know, we're going to get out tomorrow, we're going to get after it, and we're going to kill those bastards that need to be killed. Because there were plenty of them. And I think it's healthy to encourage the Marines to be aggressive, to be tenacious, but to also be present and prevent anything from going too far. But I think the only way you're going to be able to do that as a leader, whether you're a platoon commander, platoon sergeant, squad leader, team leader, you know, or a company commander, is if the Marines know you, if you've been out there with them in training, on patrol, and in those moments of rage where they're thinking about something that, you know, will be going too far, then having someone step in. And I think it's the same way, you know, back at the camps or back in the barracks when someone's doing something stupid, you know, having those leaders step up and have the moral courage to go, all right, guys, stop. All right, we're not going to do that. And whether they have a chance or the time to explain it or not, they're putting their foot down. And, you know, Marines, the vast majority will do the right thing because they intuitively know what the right thing is, and they're disciplined enough, if they're, you know, in a disciplined unit, to recognize they got to stay above the emotion of the fight.
And so, and you and I have talked about this before, and we'll get to April 7th here in a second, but those leaders that put an end to the hazing, that step in difficult situations when there's disagreements among Marines, that kind of discipline, that kind of leadership that starts in garrison, back wherever you come from, Camp Pendleton, Camp Lejeune, Okinawa, wherever you're coming from, that in garrison leadership is something that doesn't get fairy dusted on the flight over, and all of a sudden you're magically a leader. And you can see that now the stakes are much higher, right? And to quote Maximus, what we do in life echoes through eternity, right? What you're going to do every day in combat will echo in the rest of your life. And you need strong leaders. I had a guy who was at Quezon talked about as the siege broke and they started getting out and conducting offensive operations, they walked through a pile of decomposing bodies. And one of the Marines grabbed a femur and stuck it in his war belt. And he said, and the guy who's telling me the story is a Lance Corporal there. And he said, one of our squad leaders, you know, saw it and just quietly took about 3 quick steps to him and said, get rid of that right now. And he said, it's that kind of steady leadership, no bravado, steady that knows life and death and knows how important it is for guys to keep their nose clean and how important it is. Any comments on that, or and then we'll go to April 7th.
Yeah, so it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, and I'll paraphrase it, but it's Lord Moran. I remember General Allen, when he was the CEO of TDS, he talked about him and referenced his book, The Anatomy of Courage. And so the gist of the quote is that a man of character and peace becomes a man of courage in war. And if you know that man in peace, you know him in war. You know, and he just talks about how you can't be selfish in peace and then all of a sudden you're unselfish in war. You know, that character is a habit, that, you know, war doesn't have the power to transform. It just exaggerates the good and the evil that is already in us. So I wholeheartedly agree with you. You're not flipping a switch and all of a sudden you're making ethical decisions and, you know, doing the right thing and being disciplined. I cannot say how important I think it is for a unit to be disciplined. And when we, you know, if you talk about excellent infantry, what's excellent infantry? It's disciplined infantry. You know, a disciplined unit is an excellent unit. And I don't, there's no way you can be an undisciplined unit and be effective in that environment. I'm convinced of it. And I have yet to hear somebody argue to the contrary and convince me otherwise.
No, you know, it's really interesting, you know, doing All Marine Radio with Mike Musselman. Mike, in his capacity as a battalion gunner, as a regimental gunner, and division gunner, gets to go out and see units. And he and I had a conversation once about him being the regimental gunner of 1st Marines when you and I were in Afghanistan with him and going out and doing battlefield circulation. With our regimental commander, now Major General Dave Furness. But I asked him, I said, how long does it take to tell if a unit's disciplined once you get there? He said, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I said, explain it to me. The way they wear their uniforms, the way they greet you, the cleanliness, right? How they look, how they conduct themselves. You know, the air is just full of it, full of their discipline or lack of it. And I said, what did it make you feel when you saw disciplined units? He said, it made me sad. He said, I know it's probably not like the cool Marine thing to say, but what I knew was more Marines were going to die than necessary because they weren't going to do the right things. They weren't going to be disciplined. And it just, that's a heavy burden. That's a heavy price to pay to be undisciplined. But I'd seen enough of it, and I know the truth. And echoing what you say about discipline. So interesting stuff.
Yeah, I also just one more thing on that. Sometimes I think people mistake discipline for being rigid.
Right.
And I think you can be a disciplined unit that is creative, that is open to, you know, discourse among the unit leaders and different ideas and, you know, empowerment of, you know, decision making down to the lowest level. So it doesn't mean you're an automaton, just because you're disciplined. It just means you're doing the right things when nobody's looking and you ruthlessly enforce standards and you apply a high degree of attention to detail to everything you do. Because, like you mentioned, without it, Marines are going to get hurt and maybe even die unnecessarily.
And that's the painful part, is unnecessarily, because we should be better than that. But as we said, if you don't embrace it in garrison and you don't conduct business like that, nobody's fairy dusting you on the chartered 747. You know, out when you're leaving the country, it doesn't happen like that. You're going to pay a prize in combat to learn those lessons that you should have learned in garrison. I remember Bobby Knight, last thing, and then I'll throw it back to you, but Bobby Knight said, discipline is doing what you have to do, when you have to do it, doing it the right way, doing it that way every time, and then being able to handle variations of that situation, coordinate with each other to be able to create the same outcome on a consistent basis. And I thought that was pretty good, I mean, for a sports coach anyway. But, you know, I mean, I thought it was a pretty good summation of what is discipline. And it's not screaming and yelling. That is the Disneyland version that we do at recruit training. And that is not discipline. Discipline is the internal mechanisms that we have that lead to success and lead to efficient fighting And so there's a huge difference. And I think as we all mature as leaders, we see it, we know it, and hopefully we're able to replicate it.
Agree. And I will tell you this, if I could. The Marine in the company that I think was the master of infusing discipline into that unit and doing so in a manner that the Marines internalized it was my company general, who remains by far the fiercest Marine I have ever fought alongside in my entire career, Winston Haugen. What a tremendous, tremendous Marine. Oh, my goodness. He's incredible.
Living in Sacramento, California.
That's right.
I sent Chris a text message about a month ago when I was up there seeing my sister. I said, hey, man, find out if I can meet Winston. So at some point our paths will cross. All right, walk us through April 7th.
So we sent Joker 2 out into the most contested part of the city, at least what was the most contested on the previous day. And sure enough, you know, I get a call from the platoon commander. Things are starting to happen. What we did better on that second day was I waited until I had a little bit more certainty as to where they were located. And I think we did a better job of coordinating the reinforcement or the link up under contact. So we just headed straight down MSR Michigan from the combat outpost and linked up with 2nd Platoon, probably a few hundred meters east of the cemetery, near what was known as 20th Street. And most of our contact at that point was coming from the south.
Okay.
And so we basically dismounted the vehicles that we were on, and we just started clearing south. Probably within the first few minutes, maybe first 30 minutes of that engagement, one of my squad leaders from 2nd Platoon was kind of signaling towards us, and so my radio operator, Corporal Gonzalez, and I made our way across the street to the east, got into a compound, and the reason he was signaling to us was because he had an urgent casualty. One of our young Marines, PFC Christopher Mabry, from Chunky, Mississippi, had been stitched through the chest. Doc was working feverishly on him, and a couple of his buddies were in the compound helping secure it. And so, you know, there was a lot of confusion back. And then, you know, as far as, you know, who was shooting who, where the enemy was. And so those guys were pretty frustrated, understandably, because they had no idea, you know, at that level that we were coming and, you know, where we were coming from. So there was some thought that, you know, there might have been some fratricide, and in particular, you know, that Mabry had been hit by one of our heavy machine gunners, or, you know, one of the heavy machine gunners in the engagement. Which, you know, again, whether it was good fortune or not, I was on the scene, and there was no way, I mean, Mabry was in a bad way, but there was just no way that he had been hit by a high caliber weapon system, because had he been hit by one of those, it would have been a different scene. So talk about, you know, tenacity and resiliency between the doc and the two, I think it was Lyles and Lopez, the two Marines that were in his fire team, or at least in 2nd platoon that were there. I just grabbed them and said, hey, guys, right now what we got to sort out is how we're going to get Mabry out of here. So they loaded him up on a high-back Humvee, and one of our company armorers, Lance Corporal Griffin, I think is from Alabama. I just looked him in the eye and said, Griff, I don't care what you do, you got to get him to the combat outpost. And, you know, he's a good 2 kilometers into the city, so he had to get, you know, 2 kilometers east. So him and another vehicle, you know, how they did it, I don't know, through sheer force of will, but they fought their way 2 kilometers to the east to get to the combat outpost and had Mabry medevaced. And unfortunately, he succumbed to his wounds that same day. But damn it, if those guys didn't come back, you know, as soon as they dropped Mabry off to get back into the fight. And we wound up fighting, you know, most of that day, and I was moving with 2nd Platoon initially. You probably remember, one of the squad leaders that I was moving with, Sergeant Abbott, because he stayed on for another deployment and wound up serving in, I think, the end of General Mattis's time as First MARDIV and the beginning of General Natonsky's time as part of the PSD. And when I think of an archetypal, you know, Marine rifle squad leader, I think of that guy, because moving behind him through those streets for a good portion of that morning and watching him employing not only his personal weapon, but fighting his squad, shooting AT-4s. I mean, he was an absolute animal. I mean, it's something that's etched in my mind and will be for the rest of my life, how fierce he was, how fearless he was. But at one point, when we were probably a kilometer south into the city, you know, my radio operator, Gonzo, says, "Hey, sir, there's a squad, you know, I think it was from 4th Platoon moving, and they didn't have a radio, and they were very quickly, you know, maintaining contact, but they were very quickly moving deeper and deeper into the southern part of the city where I didn't at that point have any units." So, you know, that's where a decision gets made for you. And Gonzo and I separated from Sergeant Abbott and Joker 2-2 and headed to link up with Corporal Southern and his squad. And finally, when I caught up to him, we kind of slowed down, you know, cleared a house, got to the rooftop, and I was working on the radio to try and make contact with, you know, the rest of his platoon, 4th Platoon, or some other element, because we were on that rooftop and we were doing some good things. But as you know, the enemy very quickly realizes where you are. They started concentrating their fire on us, and we were running real low on ammunition. This is like one of those instances where I would tell our students, you know, you have to stay above the emotional fight. And this was probably not a great example for me, because, you know, the Marines were pretty insistent about, you know, trying to move out and link up on the street. And so we did make an attempt, but it was unsuccessful. And in the process, you know, one of my Marines, Lance Corporal Miller, took a round to the back of, you know, just below his head, the, you know, upper part of his back, and he dropped right there in the street, because as soon as we left the compound that we were in, we were blasted with, you know, machine gun fire. So we got back in the house that we had been in, and Gonzo and I were like the last two to get back on the compound from the street. So as soon as I get in, everybody's laughing. You know, this is after, you know, we have a Marine go down. I mean, he dropped, and I thought, you know, now I have hopefully an urgent casualty. I hope it's not routine, because if it's routine, it means he's been killed. But I get back in the compound, everybody's laughing, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, either the Marines have lost their mind, which is not a good thing, or I've lost my mind, which is, you know, probably worse. But it turns out the sappy plate stopped the round. He had just been knocked out. So he was pretty groggy, and he, you know, Lance Corporal Miller, he was out of it. But, you know, thankfully, you know, thank God he was alive. And so at that moment, I just said, all right, we're not going to try and make a bold escape again, with, you know, we were 10 Marines total, my radio operator and I included. And I forgot to mention that 50% of that squad was wounded. You know, they were ambulatory, but they were suffering from, shrapnel wounds that they had received from all the RPGs and grenades flying around. So we waited. You know, I mean, we're fighting in a much more limited fashion, trying to conserve ammo from that rooftop. And eventually my XO was moving with 3rd Platoon. And I don't think I've expended that many pyrotechnics other than maybe on R5 and CBS to try and, you know, signal to them where to link up with us. And they finally linked up. We still had a couple hundred meters that we had to move through the city to get to the soccer stadium, which was our link-up point. And then we linked up there, and I had all 3rd Platoon, all 4th Platoon, and we, you know, basically did a company movement, you know, northeast back out of the city to finish up the afternoon.
Can you talk in, now I'm sure you've had a lot of time to study this. What was going on in Ramadi that day? What was, why did they ball up? What were they trying to do? Do you have an idea, a good idea now? Or was it simply they wanted they thought they could pick a fight and win it, and they were going to test you guys. What happened?
Well, I do think their confidence was higher than it should have been, which is fine. You know, I've made a lifetime of being underestimated, and in this case, it was no different. But I remember General Kennedy telling us, you know, that there had been a report that the enemy, the insurgents, had referred to the Marines as soft cake. And part of that, I think, may have been because of the incessant interaction we were attempting with the population and, you know, handing out flyers or whatever, school supplies or other things we were trying to do. And the enemy viewed that as weak. So although it was not as well coordinated as they had hoped, I thought it was pretty well planned, and I think they had stacks of ammunition, you know, machine guns, assault rifles, RPGs throughout the city. I mean, I thought it was, you know, looking back on where the engagements occurred, and it was like they were fighting, you know, a delay mission in certain parts of the city and knew where their primary, alternate, and supplemental battle positions were. And, you know, it's still hard to assess, at least for me. I mean, I had a soda straw view of Iraq because that, you know, 5x6 kilometer area was the only area I operated in during that deployment.
Right.
But I think, you know, it was a provincial assault. You know, what was interesting was getting together with a lot of my buddies, many of whom taught with me at IOC, and talking about what they were experiencing, whether it was out west or out east, or, you know, my brother-in-law was fighting up north with, up near Samara with the army. And when you compare notes, you know, a lot of the tactics, techniques, and procedures the enemy was using were pretty consistent, and their timing, I think, actually was pretty good, but, it just wasn't effective. Like I would say to my Marines, that was the last piece of cake they, ever attempted to eat, as far as I'm concerned.
Chris, what
I would usually use the explicit as when I say that statement, of course.
That's it. You know, you are a Naval Academy grad, so we expect a little bit more from you. What? Talk to us about their tactics. I mean, would they look to find somebody who they thought they could surround and destroy, and seize on that? Did they seem to care about the size of formations? Do you have any sense of that? What were they looking? Were they looking to find a squad who was a little bit more remote and get on them and kill them and destroy them? What were they trying to do?
I think so. I think it was an attempt. It was always an attempt by them to isolate, outnumber, start inflicting casualties, and they know we're going to go get our guys that are wounded. So there's only so many routes there, and then that would therefore put them at a position of advantage to dictate the tempo of the battle and how it went. So I absolutely think they were always seeking to isolate, outnumber, overwhelm, and inflict casualties. And so that experience on those first 2 days changed how we approached patrolling, for sure. How we, you know, what size element I would send out into the city. You know, of course, we would still do small unit, you know, when I say small unit, squad-level patrols, but connecting files, which are important in an urban environment to begin with, become increasingly important. You know, mutual support becomes increasingly important. The ammo that they carried, you know, I defined, this was just my own definition, a sustained engagement of 30 minutes. And based off of where Marines were going and what their mission was, I made sure that I could get to them in that amount of time.
Right.
So my guidance to squad leaders was, you got to be able to fight for 30 minutes. And at the end of that 30 minutes, I'm going to be there, you know, with a reinforcement, you know, with the reserve, with the QRF. And so, you know, my advice to my successor, Jeff Kenny, another IOC instructor who had Gulf 2-5, was, don't go anywhere in the city with less than a reinforced rifle platoon unless you can get to that unit very quickly with an element of that size, because the relative combat power that we needed to succeed, you know, at that time, in that environment, was a reinforced rifle platoon. And when I say reinforced, it's, you know, reinforced with machine guns and assault weapons. You know, no, nothing more than that, really.
Got it. All right. My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Chris Bronzy, Colonel Select. He was in 2004, which is what we're talking about. He was a commanding officer of Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, known as the Magnificent Bastards. They were fighting as part of the 1st Brigade Combat Team in the city of Ramadi in the spring of 2004 underneath the Blue Diamond of the 1st Marine Division, commanded at the time by Major General J.N. Mattis, and the Deputy Commanding General was Brigadier General John Kelly, the Chief of Staff, Colonel Joe Dunford. So a little bit, there's some heavy leadership on just across the other side of the river. Lessons learned, Chris.
Well, the four phases of an attack in an urban environment, I think, remain relevant. You know, recon, isolate, secure, foothold, and seize. I already mentioned the importance of reconnaissance, and I think that transcends, you know, generations of warfare and, you know, all the possible environments you could, you know, you could fight in. Use of the reserve, one of the things I would always try and emphasize, particularly with the captains who are going out of EWS to be company commanders, is, you know, employ it. Don't protect it. Once you commit it, it's no longer the reserve, but that's okay because you can reconstitute the reserve. And it's not just something to employ in a defensive posture. It's something you can employ in the offense as well. You'd ask me when I got back from Iraq, Mac, you know, what was one of the most important lessons I learned? And I would say, you know, maintain the fighting spirit of your men. And it's difficult, and it's a team effort. You know, it requires an exhaustive effort. It requires, you know, discipline. It requires encouragement. It requires talking to them and trying to explain things when you can and listening to their ideas and, you know, ensuring that everybody has ownership of the success. And, you know, the failures that you experience, well, I should say I owned all the failures, but making sure that they understood that they were, you know, they owned the success. I think reinforcing a unit in contact is still one of the hardest things we have to do.
Right.
I think engaging your Marines after a loss, being firm but also being fair. You know, like I said, I love those guys. Still do to this day, but love is more than a feeling. It's a responsibility. And it's particularly hard, I think, as a new platoon commander to appreciate that, especially because you're the same age as a lot of your Marines and, in fact, younger than a lot of them. Avoiding the victim's mentality. Those first few weeks of that deployment, it was tough because it was hard to identify the enemy. It was hard to maintain contact with the enemy. And not succumbing to, you know, the woe is me attitude because, like that great company gunny I had used to say, hey, sir, they're gonna make a mistake. And when they do, we're gonna be there to catch them. And eventually we were. Exercising tactical patience. You know, I gave that example of making a bad decision on the 7th of April and, not staying above the emotion of fighting, deciding to try and leave the compound when it just was not a good idea. And I was lucky. You know, I'd rather be lucky than good sometimes, but in that case, I was lucky. And thanks to the tenacity of my XO, he found us, we linked up, and we were able to fight our way out of the city successfully without incurring any more casualties. But, yeah, those are probably the highlights that I draw from that day. It was a certainly a rewarding experience, but I think at the same time it, you know, came at a cost that you can never, you just can't make it up. You know, it's we're not going to get those three Marines that we lost over those 2 days back. And it was certainly hard to look some of their brothers in the eye and tell them, hey, you got to get back after it. But I can't tell you how impressed I was with the heart that those Marines showed. Getting right back the next day and getting after it. It's impressive, and it was everything that I had read about, you know, studying, you know, what 2-5 and 1-5 did in World War II, you know, what the Magnificent Bastards did at Dai Do. And I had an interest in Vietnam because that generation submarine closer to me than any other. But it's incredible. The Marine Corps, I think the Marine Corps gets it right. You know, who they recruit and how they train them. And that esprit de corps becomes increasingly important in an environment like this, without a doubt.
A final word about discipline. In fact, you just spoke of it there, you know, that we do it right. The tending to discipline when you're in garrison, in the menial tasks, all that leads you to the battlefield. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. And I agree. You know, you achieve discipline through training. You know, it has to define our every action. You know, not only how we fight, how we prepare for combat. I remember Trent Gibson used to teach lieutenants at IOC, and he would tell them, you know, prep for combat is the hallmark of a true professional. And it's true. You know, the plan is nothing. Planning is everything. But how we wear our uniforms and gear. I mean, you talked about how Gunnar Musselman said, you know, showing up at a position, wherever that position was, no matter how remote it was, and being able to look at a unit and know that they were disciplined. And I think being disciplined means you're fit physically. It means you're fit mentally. You have that element of will, that force of personality that is contagious, and it makes Marines happy. You know, it makes Marines happy and makes them more effective. And it also makes you hard to kill. You know, a disciplined unit is harder to kill. And that was always something that was being emphasized in the Blue Diamond. You know, making ourselves hard to kill and giving the enemy no rest. You know, just pursuing them relentlessly. And the more the enemy is thinking about looking over his shoulder because he knows we're going to catch him, the less he is refining his plans for attack against us. So.
You know, a final question, and if you have any closing comments, feel free. But one of the things that I think that's extremely difficult to deal with in combat is the role that luck plays. I think you said twice during the interview, you made a comment about luck, but your last comment was, you know, sometimes it's really good to be lucky. Talk about that, because you know, bad luck can be devastating, and it can be nothing more than that. You know, why does it hit him and not me? Why does it hit them and miss all of us? Is there anything you can do as a leader to massage that? Because it's certainly difficult to accept the randomness of the battlefield and the uncertainty of the battlefield, and a lot of it, you know, combat luck. Your thoughts on that?
It's funny because I remember General Allen used to say a lot at TBS, you know, you make your own luck.
Right.
And I don't know that I still to this day fully appreciate what he was getting at, but I do think that, you know, your preparation, being a student of the profession, you're going to tend towards certainly increasing your chance of success, but I think in the case that he was making, you're going to make better luck for yourself. And, you know, when a good thing happens to you that maybe shouldn't have happened, I think it's important to emphasize it and, you know, to make note of it. But at the same time, and this was something lieutenants asked me a couple days ago, you know, so when your unit starts taking casualties, how do you react to it? And what do you, what do you do? Well, for me personally, you know, I had to compartmentalize the information. I had to, you know, really make an effort to focus on what the unit was doing. And everybody's looking at you, and you're so busy as a unit leader. I don't care what level, whether it's fire team, squad, platoon, or company. And I won't say it's easy to stay focused, but I think it's easier than you might expect. But those are the types of things that I think help you make your own luck, so to speak.
Okay.
And, yeah, Mac, I mean, bad stuff happens, and how do you explain it? Sometimes you just can't explain it. But I think the way you get through it is when your unit believes in what they're doing, when they believe in their leadership, when they trust one another, when they trust their leaders. And as I mentioned with our chain of command, you know, the environment I felt like I was operating in, the individuals that I felt I was working for, I trusted them. And so, you know, we would repeatedly ask for like an armored reserve to be stationed at the combat outpost. And, you know, it was probably a bold request and it never was fulfilled. And I guess we could have got hung up on the fact that we were doing, you know, fighting almost every day and that it would have made a difference, but they didn't have it to give. And I believe that they didn't have it to give and that, you know, sometimes you're a supporting effort and that's okay. But we're going to be the, you know, most proficient, most lethal supporting effort that ever walked the face of the earth. That was my approach. And I think that was the approach of, you know, the fellow company commander that I had that, you know, were terrific guys like Rob Weiler, guys like, Mark Carlton, who had Fox Company, you know, Wilson Leach. And you mentioned, you know, obviously our battalion commander, Sergeant Major Booker, you know, J.D. Harrell, just a phenomenal team. And then more important than all that was just the high caliber Marines that we had. And a lot of them, I think I had almost over 50 new Marines join the unit between Thanksgiving and when we deployed in February.
Wow.
So that, in my mind, is a testament to those NCOs. And not just the NCOs, but to the Marines who were in leadership positions that maybe weren't wearing, you know, the rank of corporal, but they had experience and they were leaders. Whatever rank you're at, you can be a leader. And they helped assimilate those Marines and supervise those Marines. And, you know, within a matter of hours, you can become a more experienced PFC, at least in terms of combat, than some of the staff NCOs or officers that walk around the division.
You know, the it's interesting because the deployment that 2-4 was on during the march up, they got extended. How many months on Okinawa? 13 or something like that?
I think it was 13. It was at least a year. It may have been as long as 13. And a lot of those Marines came on our deployment to Iraq with us.
Right. And so these are Marines who had never been to combat before, and they've been sitting on Okinawa. But and Chris just talked about assimilating all those new Marines into their company and being able to fight. I want to end on kind of a funny story and talk about the levity while all this stuff is going on. Tell everybody what Lieutenant Colonel Kennedy used to do to you when you'd be in a firefight.
he didn't come on the radio too much, but I remember not just one occasion, but repeated occasions I would be calling in a situation report or a contact report, you know, bastard, usually I call in to the op, so bastard 3, this is Joker 6, you know, contact, checkpoint 296, platoon size element, you know, no casualties, and he would break in and say, Bronzy, it's, you know, or hey, Joker 6, sounds like you're calling from underneath your rack, back in your firm base, surrounded by sandbags with the lights turned off. Are you sure you're at checkpoint 296? And it was great because, like you said, it added levity to the situation, and that's important. You know, I think as tough of a deployment as it was, we enjoyed it, you know, and we laughed. And you have to. I mean, that, you know, that's important to getting through that experience. But yeah, General Kenny would do that kind of stuff all the time. It was awesome.
What did you think the first time when you heard it? What?
I didn't know how to respond. I was like, I know I'm actually at checkpoint 296, and I know I'm in a firefight. Maybe it's not intense enough for him to measure as a firefight. We had only been together for, by the time we got to Iraq, maybe 7 months. But he spent a lot of time with us. He spent a lot of time talking to us, challenging us, offering us his insight, his experience. And I think in a very short period of time, you know, I felt like I got to appreciate what he was looking for. And if I wasn't providing it, then he would certainly tell me. And having thick skin, and you know, having worked at the basic school in IOC, you can't get through that place without having thick skin.
Right.
And I think the older you get, at least I would like to think, the more you welcome constructive criticism and feedback. And in that environment, hell, you know, I would talk to my squad leaders pretty frequently, or I thought it was frequently, and ask them, okay, what can we do better? How can we be more lethal? You know, what ideas do you have? And, you know, I have great snipers that supported our company. And they were very creative. And I tell you, those guys, they did everything. I mean, they did windows. Whatever we asked of them, they would do. And, very mature, very articulate, very intelligent NCOs who, would offer, you know, ideas that we would frequently execute and, do so to great, you know, to great success.
Bruns, first of all, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day and doing this. Awesome stuff. And I'm glad that this will be the first one in a whole series aimed at, company level leadership and really anybody who wants to hear about battles that we fought, in the Marine Corps. And guys that are still around to talk about it and the lessons they've learned from them. And I think it's a great oral tradition. I think the lessons learned are many. And so, thank you very much for being the first battlefield study here, Golf Company 2-4 in Ramadi on April 6th, 7th. So thank you very much, bud.
Hey, Mac, no problem. I appreciate you listening. You know, I can never do justice to the heroic actions of the Marines that I was fortunate enough to stand in front of. And I will tell you, our nation owes them its soul. In every opportunity that folks get to serve Marines in this kind of environment, as difficult as it is by far the most rewarding experience professionally and personally that I've had in my life. So, yeah, I appreciate everything that you're doing. You know, your radio show on the Internet in the Pentagon actually works. is well-needed entertainment. I feel like I'm back with RCT1, you know, every time I listen to you guys. But, yeah, you know, it's good to be us, and appreciate talking with you.
No, you know, I say it over and over, and it's great to have guys like you come on and, you know, unsolicited say the same thing, that there is no way to do justice to the courage and selflessness that you're privileged to see when you're smart enough at a very young age to join the Marine Corps, and then you go in harm's way, and you just see the courage and the selflessness of young Marines under fire in a sustained way. It just takes your breath away. It affects you for the rest of your life. It affects you for the rest of your life. And I'll tell you what, it was my privilege to spend a little bit of time with you on the Bastards of Golf Company. And one of the treasured memories I have, being out there with Colonel Kennedy and General Kelly and Dan Robertson, was out there with us that day. So, again, thanks for doing this, and all the best of luck to you in the future.
Thanks, Mac. I'll talk to you again with you soon, brother.
There you have it. That is Chris Bronzy here on the first Battlefield Study on All Marine Radio. More of this coming up next. Don't touch that dial. So that concludes it. On a Wednesday, the inaugural edition of our Battlefield Studies. And Chris Bronzy, if you can't tell, chosen very deliberately. He's what you expect when you write the word Marine officer, and in particular Marine infantry officer. He's a great leader and a great guy. Through thick or thin, you don't have to look to see if Bronzy's there. He'll be there. And he shows up, and he'll do anything. I'm Bronzy. I'm here to paint, is the way he rolls. Anyway, thanks for listening today. If you're just tuning into the program, don't touch that dial, because you're going to hear a great series of interviews today here on All Marine Radio. So my thanks to Bob Nielsen for turning me on to Bob Delvecchio. What you're about to hear as we go back to the top of the show, Bob Delvecchio is a combat cameraman, United States Marine Corps, Vietnam era. And he takes issue with the Ken Burns, Lynn Novak documentary. And specifically, he doesn't believe they tell the stories that they kind of allude to. He said, you know, you see these things and they're like icebergs. They show an image, but they don't tell the story behind it. And so what he does is he kind of pulls back the curtain on a whole series of things that he believes they don't tell completely. And I think you'll find it extremely compelling. If you watch the series, you need to listen to the Bob Delvecchio interview that's coming up. It will help round out your Vietnam education. Yeah, and it's good to listen to. So, and then after that, Chris Bronzy, chosen deliberately to do an interview, our first battle study, when he was the company commander for Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, the Magnificent Bastards. So you'll hear that. So Bronzy, good stuff. My thanks to him for doing that. So on Wednesday, All Marine Radio, out. Don't touch that dial. Good stuff follows. Have a great day.